quartered. What? Won't talk? Answer me! I gasped, trying to suck air into my lungs, and shook my head. She drew her boot back, and her hair rose about her like a storm cloud. No, never, I wheezed. Fuck, fuck, fuck. I was gonna die here, unless I got my shit together immediately. Where'd I drop the belaying pin? I wondered if the talking cannonball in my satchel could hear me. I gasped, Jusher, kill this woman. Mevis glanced around for who I might be talking to. I didn't wait to see if Jusher would actually help. The moment she was distracted, I renewed my concentration on her. She was different than Kadir, far more complex. I riffled through bands of names and appellations that layered her like one of those Russian dolls. I realized she wasn't human, and in fact was much older than she looked, like hundreds of years older, which was why I was having such a difficult time getting her number. She was too tangled to encapsulate, at least quickly. So I tried the next best thing. Mevish, I said, and her eyes snapped back to me. Stop, or I'll reveal what you really are to your friends. I'll tell your comrades and your captain. You'll be without a home once more and without friends. I had no idea how she'd react, or even if I was on the right track. If she ignored me, and instead kicked me hard enough, quickly enough, I wouldn't be able to scream out the truth about her. And why would a bunch of pirates believe some poor loser lost in the glass desert anyway? But my threat shocked Mevis into a startled stare. She glanced sideways, then back at me. She whispered, "Do not." "Then go help Saraja now, or you're done here." To my own ears, I managed to speak with the dread authority of a storybook villain, with only a slight quaver. Mevish actually growled at me before she turned away. As she did, her lashing hair spread out into four separate twining braids. The braids converged on the man in red. Lurin was his name, and easily wrapped him up by his wrists and ankles. The hair obviously had an impressive power all its own, because Mevish actually grabbed Lauren up and held him in the air with her animate hair. His scream of surprise turned into one of horrified agony a second before she pulled off both his arms. All the conversation on the ship ceased, as did the jibes that Saraja and Kadir had been throwing back and forth at each other. Everyone was looking at Mevish as she tossed Lurin's spurting remains. Then she pointed at Kadir and said simply, "Go. I've decided that actually Saraja is a better fit for this crew." Kadir and Saraja both looked surprised, but Saraja adapted first and grinned. "Goodbye, Kadir. You can't beat me and Mevish together." "And me," I said, then coughed. I'm not sure anyone actually heard me. Kadir said, "But you were demoted. I should be first mate." "Captain Timon made his decree. Only one of us is welcome back aboard," said Saraja. "And that's me. Get going, before Mevish adds to her arm collection." Kadir scowled. Then his shoulders slumped. He understood that he'd lost. He finally managed to grab the hammer I'd commanded him to drop. He flipped off the assembled crew, still watching from the deck of the Night Star, then walked away under the merciless sun. I stood up. "Are you coming?" Saraja asked me, then pointed to the pirate ship. I nodded, though part of me wanted to follow Kadir and get away from these bloodthirsty thugs. Except I'd die from heatstroke if I didn't get more water soon. So I said, "I thought you'd never ask." Chapter 18. Revelation. Catherine Manners. 2 months later.
"Those dreams still bothering you?" said Raoul.
"Now isn't the time," said Kate. The last thing she wanted to think about were her nightmares. The unfamiliar voices, finding herself lost in bizarre locations. Nope.
Not the time for it. So instead, she grabbed Raoul's name badge and gave it a final once-over as the elevator ascended. She had faked up reasonable facsimiles of computer contractor IDs from a company in Portland, Oregon, she'd picked at random from an online registry. They wouldn't stand up to detailed scrutiny if they were discovered in Garland Klein's private office, but she was reassured that a casual glance at least wouldn't blow their cover. "We don't need to rush in," insisted Raoul, as the floors flashed higher on the elevator display. "I worried about you. You look tired." Kate sighed. "All right, yes, I still get those dreams. More frequently than ever," she didn't add. Last night, she dreamed she fell through her bedroom floor and directly onto a desert made of glass. In the dream, she burned her feet. The ring Carter had left behind, which also featured in her dream, had spoken in her mind. The pain from her feet woke her before she was able to parse the ring's message. Her soul still ached, but they hadn't been physically scorched when she checked in the morning light. And the ring, which she kept in a tiny plastic case, remained speechless. It was just another dream. Wasn't that what Dana Scully would say? She could imagine the hero of skeptics everywhere telling her exactly that. Kate sighed. Sometimes, though, she just wanted to believe. To be a hero, not someone who catches people cheating on their significant others. So why was she feeling so off-kilter? Everything that happened meant that her chance to be a hero, to believe in something amazing, was happening all around her. To her, even. Was the fear of being disappointed still holding her back after everything? Raoul broke her stream of consciousness with a cough. "We should talk about this. It could be related to your contact with Ardeen and the Strange." The elevator door slid open. "Not now," she said, setting off down the corridor. At 2 in the morning, the September Project office in Portland, Oregon, was deserted. Except for a few lamps shining from adjoining offices, it was also dark. Dream analysis from a friend, especially a friend who seemed as if he was dealing with his own brain issues, was a distraction they couldn't afford. For once, Raoul did as she asked and kept stride with her in silence. When they reached Gordon Klein's office, Kate applied the key card they'd stolen a day earlier at a coffee shop. The lock clicked open. They strolled in like they owned the place. Luckily, the corner office was deserted. Raoul closed the door to the hallway while Kate flipped on the lights. The office was swank. The window blinds were lowered, and they were alone. Kate made a beeline for the desk. As her intelligence hinted, the safe was located in the first place she would have looked anyway, behind the large painting of Mount Hood behind Klein's desk. Raoul finished checking the auxiliary office and gave her a thumbs up. Thankfully, they hadn't walked in on a secretary, cleaning person, or, worst of all, Klein himself. She leaned the painting along the wall and turned to the safe. Too bad it didn't have an electronic lock. She was far more confident of her ability to hack circuits than finesse tumblers. From her briefcase, which she'd settled on the desk, she selected her safe-cracking tool. A stethoscope. She settled in to try her luck. Just as she was getting into the groove, Raoul said, "These fellows certainly hit the ground running. I figured they would need another year to get financing." Kate glanced up, biting back an irritated comeback. Raoul was reading through the glitzy marketing pamphlets from the desktop. She'd seen those same pitches online, making claims about the future wonders quantum computing would offer. She doubted the pamphlets mentioned where the quantum breakthrough had originated. With a noncommittal she returned to her work. Safe-cracking, by dint of old-fashioned lock manipulation, wasn't easy. It required tremendous patience. If she failed, she'd have to resort to her fallback option. An explosive detonation which would draw whatever security lurked in the newly decorated offices of September Project, LLC, so she hoped it wouldn't come to that. Raoul watched her without further interruptions for another minute before shrugging, dropping the pamphlets and bending to his smartphone. Kate still worried about Raoul. That worry was probably the reason she'd been so short with him lately. He seemed back to normal, but her trust would never return completely. She'd seen someone else look out from Raoul's eyes. Instead of her friend, for a little while, he'd been Jason. Supposedly, he was back to being Raoul again. Except, how could she know for sure? What? Raoul was looking at her. She realized she turned all the way around and was staring at him, not safe-cracking. Kate sighed. Maybe now was the time after all. They were alone, and the safe wasn't going anywhere. Raoul, you said that Jason's gone, and maybe that's true. But look at it from my perspective. There's no way for me to test it, especially if he can draw on your memories and pretend to be you.
Listen.
Let me finish. The thing is, you know a lot more about all this than you should. Even more than me. And I am the one who brought you in. For instance, why are you so concerned about my stupid dreams? Do you know something? And why the hell do you think they'd have anything to do with Ardeen, or what'd you call it, the Strange? What gives?
I told you, said Raoul slowly, a pained expression on his face. Jason let a few things slip and I picked the
bullshit, said Kate. I'm the one who found out about the September Project, not you. Why didn't Jason let that slip?
It doesn't work like, Raoul started.
On the other hand, she gestured with the stethoscope chest piece she'd been using on the safe, you have this unsettling new familiarity with all this, or as I heard you mutter last week, the limited worlds beneath Earth. I guarantee you that stuff isn't on Wikipedia, because I've looked.
Raoul rubbed his eyes. Finally he said, they're called recursions, Kate.
What are?
The limited worlds that Earth hosts. And you're right, I do know more about this than I've let on. I've always known.
I knew it! She'd spoken louder than she'd intended. Pitching her voice back to a whisper, she said, "You're still Jason." Her hand dropped to her 9mm holster.
"No, Jason returned to Ardeen, but I've never been exactly who you think. I'm, well, there's no easy way to say this. Like you said before, this isn't the time to go in.
It's the perfect time." He glanced around Klein's office, swallowed, and said,
"All right. Brace yourself."
"I'm braced."
"I'm not from Earth. I'm from a recursion. One that has hidden in the dark energy network, we call it the Strange, long before Ardeen was created by Carter Morrison."
"Well, she hadn't seen that coming."
Raoul said, "Say something. You must have questions."
He studied her, a hesitant smile on his lips, as her mind tried to make sense of the man's admission. She said, "Oh, come on. So, you're telling me, what, that you're an alien?"
Raoul shrugged. "I've taken on Earth's context. I've been Raoul for 20 years. I'm as human as you, Kate."
20 years? Why? And what were you before? Given everything else that had happened, Kate realized that she couldn't rule out Raoul's story merely on principle. The "that's crazy" ship had sailed several months ago, the night she'd met Jason's homunculus at BDR. Raoul said, "Do you understand what I am saying?"
"No."
"Yes. Jesus Christ, Raoul."
The fuck of it all was that Raoul was probably telling the truth. Of course, that didn't mean he wasn't a fuckhead who'd lied to her since the first day they'd met. He came from a world like Jason's. Even if he wasn't Jason, how many fucking worlds were there under Earth anyway?
He said, "I was The office door beeped, and someone rattled the lock. Kate ducked. Her hand was already on Malcolm's holster, and she loosed the safety snap. Raoul slipped around the desk and scrunched down beside her. He saw her hand on the gun and whispered, "Wait." Kate waited by pulling the 9mm free. Ever since she and Carter had been caught flat-footed by Liza Banks' hired goon, she'd been putting in a few hours a week at a gun range in Bellevue. Her confidence with the piece had increased a lot, though the way her heart pounded and hands shook, maybe she'd been fooling herself. A voice outside the office said, "See? Empty." Kate remembered that she left her briefcase sitting open on the desk. Worse, the normally hidden safe was plainly visible. The gig would be up if the office door opened. Shit. "I heard a woman talking," another voice said. "A woman? You wish." Kate risked a peek around the desk. Two security guards loomed in the hallway light. "Don't be a dick," one guard said. "Why are the lights on in here? They weren't an hour ago. We should check it out using the new procedure." Guard two said, "Fine." "It's not fine," Kate thought as she ducked back out of sight. What was the new procedure? Grenade first, inspect after? But instead of chucking explosives, the sound of a single set of footsteps receded, as did the second guard's voice as he said, "If the freak is still here, she can do another scan." "Her name is Soma," replied guard one, apparently still loitering just outside the entrance to the office. Raoul's eyes found Kate's. He gave her a nod, as if that meant anything to her. Then he hopped up and over the desk, unlocked the office door, and eased it open. Shocked that he'd revealed their position, she stood up before she could think better of it. She kept her gun concealed behind her back. The nearer guard was watching his partner move off down the hallway. Before he realized he wasn't alone, Raoul slipped up behind him and applied a chokehold. The guard made a soft noise and tried to pry Raoul's forearm from his neck, but failed. Kate shook off her astonishment at seeing Raoul move so aggressively. Today was apparently the day he decided to pull off all his masks. She whispered, "Pull him in here." She hurried to the entrance and pressed her gun to the man's temple. "Stop struggling," she hissed to the guard, "or I'll shoot." The man's eyes, already wide, locked on Malcolm. The fight went out of him, then consciousness, as the chokehold restricted enough blood to knock him out. Raoul pulled the limp form into Klein's office. The moment the guard's feet were clear at the door, she bumped it shut again. Raoul settled him to the floor. "We have to move, Michula," Raoul said. "I don't know where the other guard went, but it did not sound promising." She nodded, studying the safe. No time for finesse or worrying about Raoul's lies. Kate pulled the shaped charge from her briefcase and removed the outer packaging. She slapped the charge onto the safe front where the smooth surface, she was fairly certain, hid the locking mechanism. When everything was set, she and Raoul took shelter on the opposite side of the desk. Bang! Smoke and the acrid smell of burnt explosive filled the air. Shattered knick-knacks and shredded, smoking carcasses of books that had been on the shelves flanking the concealed safe now littered the carpet. She crept forward through the haze, careful not to step on anything sharp. The fist-sized, rough hole in the safe's surface was pretty much what she'd wanted to see. The safe door was slightly warped, but she pulled it open with a jerk. Inside were a few scorched file folders and a smaller lockbox. She grabbed everything and dumped it into her briefcase. Raoul waited for her at the door. He cracked it open and gazed into the hallway. She paused until he gave the all clear. 5 seconds passed and he didn't move. Then another 5. The hair on her arms stood up. "Raoul, what is it?" Still no response. She held her breath and approached the door. Raoul was as immobile as a statue. Dread caught at her limbs. but she pulled the door wider anyway. A woman stood in the hallway, and her eyes met Kate's. The woman's clothing was oddly wrong. Far more alarming was the haze of blue light that swirled around her head. It reminded Kate of false color images she'd seen of magnetic field lines migrating across the sun. Not something you'd expect or want to see flaring around someone's head. The woman said, "Here's your security leak. Two people. One's from Ruck, but I've got 'em." The woman was talking to the guard who'd walked off, who stood nearby. He was obviously more nervous about the blue light woman than concerned about seeing an intruder standing in Klein's office. Kate aimed her 9mm at the woman and asked, "Who are you?" She hated how her voice shook. And what was a ruck? "My name doesn't matter," the woman replied, unfazed by the gun pointed at her. "I stop oppressors and thieves like you and make them sorry. Although," the woman's hand went to her temple, "you're not just a thief, are you? Something about you is interfering with my talent. Or maybe I've just stayed too long." The authority in the woman's voice faded as she said the last. The woman gestured with her other hand. Kate's muscles seized. She tottered and almost toppled. The blue light woman was doing it. Somehow, Kate concentrated on squeezing the trigger. Something prevented her, so she redoubled her efforts. The woman yelled, "She's fighting me! She's quickened, and I..." The gun went off. Mobility suddenly returned. Her first shot had been wild. The guard threw himself to the floor. The woman looked shocked, and her weird aura was gone. "Try that again, bitch," Kate said, "and I'll put a bullet in your brain." Raoul groaned and pitched forward on his face like a marionette released by its puppeteer. In the time it took Kate to glance his way and back, the woman snatched a small object from her belt sash. "Drop it!" screamed Kate. The woman complied. The object, shaped something like a snow globe, smashed on the floor. The shards blossomed into a rip in space, a literal opening to somewhere else. Kate saw an unfamiliar city skyline in the cavity. The strange woman stepped through the hole while Kate gaped. Then the opening collapsed to the sound of distant thunder. Kate blinked. Except for cracked hallway tiles, nothing remained of the other guard, the woman who could immobilize people with a glance, or the doorway to elsewhere. Had she seen into another world? What had Raoul called it? Another recursion? Their regular coffee shop, much as she loved it, wasn't a discreet location for discussing their burglary at September Project. Plus, it was still closed at 5 in the morning, which was when they made it back to Seattle after driving north up I-5 from Portland. So Kate brought Raoul back to her condo. She'd got it cheap after the bottom fell out of the housing market in 08. The condo was comfortable enough, if small, and offered them reasonable privacy. Raoul's daze lifted after she'd set him up with a chicken salad sandwich and some iced tea at her kitchen bar. She helped herself to a second sandwich. "So, you want to talk?" Raoul said. He looked resigned. Kate chewed a bite of sandwich, then swallowed. "Yeah. Starting with that woman. The one with the blue aura. She was from a recursion?"
"She was."
"The same place as you? Ruck, she called it?"
"No. Someplace else. A different, limited world. I have no idea which one. Hundreds, maybe thousands of recursions are hosted around Earth. Most of them born from the power of human imagination, from human fiction. She must be some character in a kid's story, come to life, or maybe inspired by a fusion of several stories seeding someplace wholly new."
Kate's head swam with possibilities, but she didn't want to let herself get distracted. She said, "But you're from Ruck?" She wondered if she could believe anything he said. She wanted to, but trust had been breached. Raoul nodded. I'm pretty sure there's no novels or movies about a place by that name. I mean, if you said you were from Middle Earth or the Federation.
Ruck, like Ardeen, was crafted purposefully, said Raoul.
Ah, said Kate.
As if that explained everything. It didn't, of course.
Come on, stop making me pry it out of you. And why'd you say you were an alien?
That was your word.
So you're not an alien?
Raoul waggled the hand not holding his sandwich.
It's complicated.
Rock has hidden in Earth's shadow since before humans fully evolved. In Rock, reality operates under a different set of laws.
Amazing feats of science are easy in Rock.
We've mastered the secrets of biosculpting and genetic engineering. To say we are alien isn't really correct. Rockians are almost indistinguishable from humans and purposefully so.
Kate shook her head.
Ancient people on Rock had made themselves look human on purpose?
Or was he suggesting that Rockians had made human ancestors on Earth look like people from Rock? She decided not to pursue either line of inquiry in case she didn't like the answer. Instead, she said,
So, Rock is a recursion like Ardeen.
A tiny world, but instead of magic spells, you've got warp drive and killer robots.
Well, yes, in very broad strokes, that's correct, said Raoul.
If Ruck has been around so long, why not reveal yourself to people on Earth?
It's not our way. We are a cautious people. Plus, only a tiny percentage of Ruckians can pass between recursions, just like on Earth. Recursors are what we call people with that ability. All are rare. Special people.
Then why are you here? 20 years, you said, you've been, Raoul? I thought you were from Mexico City.
Raoul smiled. We're a fractious people. Some among us are even dangerous. A faction called the Karum is particularly outspoken in its desire to sever Rock's ties with Earth. Violently, if necessary. I came to Earth to keep an eye out for Karum activity. I was installed as a sort of sleeper agent. You might say, one of a few.
Oh, great. How many Rock natives are creeping around Earth?
I don't know. Less than a dozen, probably. It's been mostly quiet. We couldn't have guessed that the threat to Earth would come from an upstart recursion force seeded 3 years ago.
Who's we? Asked Kate.
An organization on Rock that believes that Rock is best served by Earth's continuous safety, called the Quiet Cabal. It's the faction that sent me here to guard against the Karum. Now it seems like Ardeen is the bigger threat.
Huh? She said and finished her sandwich. She hadn't really tasted it. Their conversation absorbed her attention.
At least she was no longer ravenous, which somehow made it easier to believe everything Raoul said. It pissed her off. It didn't mean she trusted him.
She said, All this time you've been an alien agent here to safeguard Earth, and you never told me. I thought you were my friend.
I am your friend, but I also have a job to do. I'm surprised you didn't suspect something, especially when I went into hiding.
Why would I?
Raoul said, You didn't think it was odd when I went underground and removed myself from society?
I just thought you were an eccentric. It's quite a leap to say, Wow, Raoul sure is weird. I wonder if he's an alien from a parallel dimension.
Ah, true. He looked sheepish.
Kate slapped the table with her palm. How was it that you came to be my friend? How could you have known that I'd one day get involved with this?
Michula, I sense something about you. You are touched by the strange, quickened, like I am, like Carter Morrison must be, and as the woman at the office who tried to fry my brain most certainly was.
Kate rocked back. What the hell do you mean by that? Quickened had been what the woman said, too. The memory of Kate's limbs locking up returned. The helpless feeling, now that the direct danger was past, made her queasy. She wished she hadn't eaten her sandwich so fast. Roel said,
Some people, whether they're from Earth or a recursion, are connected to the strange. That connection allows them to travel between recursions to take on the context of each new recursion they enter, and even call on amazing abilities. People who can do that under their own power are quickened.
Kate didn't know what to make of Raoul's explanation, but she didn't like the subtext. You say you're my friend, but really you stayed near me because you were watching me like a lab rat, to see if I'd start using strange powers. She stated it as a fact, studying Roel to see his reaction.
It wasn't like that, he said.
She kept her gaze on him. Roel blushed. Then he said,
All right, yes, at first, it was like that. But think about it, Kate. I could have watched you from a distance, and you never have been the wiser. I stayed in contact because you became my friend.
He glanced away, embarrassed.
Jesus, Roel, I just don't know.
She wanted to trust him. She had thought of him as a confidant for years. His admissions now threatened to invalidate everything between them. An uneasy quiet fell as she struggled to come to a decision. It was tempting to just trust him, because that was easiest. But easy didn't mean smart. Finally, Raoul volunteered.
We should try to figure out the nature of your quickened abilities. You held off that woman remarkably.
Kate held up a hand. Raoul stopped. Let's see what's in the safe. We can worry about whether I'm quickened later, she said. One thing at a time, she told herself. Her plate was already full. She set the briefcase on the kitchen bar and opened it. Inside was her stethoscope and other tools, plus the scorched file folders and lockbox she'd taken from the September project safe. She grabbed the files, rolled the lockbox. Coming cold to someone else's records and organizational system was always a pain. She laid out the documents, collating them until eventually she figured it out.
Damn it, she said. They've split their quantum research between locations. Portland was just a fucking HR office. We already knew they were doing the actual research somewhere else, said Raoul in a distracted voice.
He was still fiddling with the lockbox.
Yeah, well, getting to these places isn't going to be as easy as driving to Portland. One's in Brazil, and the other one, well, it's someplace I've never heard of.
And according to this document, she waved a piece of paper, we need to go to the one in Brazil before you can use the key to get to the other place.
Whatever that means, Kate sighed. Where in Brazil? Asked Raoul.
A city called Curitiba, at the Federal University.
Shit. Do we have to get a visa to travel to Brazil?
We'll check. Where's the other place? She shook her head. These files call it the Sister Foundry. It's located somewhere called Megadon. He flinched, almost dropping the lockbox, and stared at her.
What? She said. It's pronounced Megadon.
He said, his voice rough.
Fine, she said. Is Megadon in Brazil, too?
No.
Megadon, the fortress of the betrayer, Jason Cole, in other words, lies in the recursion of Ardeen.
Chapter 19 Ringmaster Jason Cole. A psychic sledgehammer smashed into Jason's mind. He bellowed a sort of obscenity scream. Worse than the pain was how his eyesight grew dim. Most disturbing of all was the explosion of brain cotton behind his eyes, so invasive that when he reached for War's facility to duplicate himself, he couldn't find it. Icy fear stabbed Jason's stomach. He whirled, lashing out blindly with his staff. He struck something that grunted with a deep, earthy tone. He backed away, blinking. He hoped his retreat was in the direction of the dragon's lair's exit. Jason had entered the crumbling opening high on the side of the dead volcano, thinking to slip in unnoticed. No such luck. At least whatever faced him probably wasn't the dragon itself, because the tunnel was too small to contain Merritt's bulk. Unless she could shrink herself. Maybe the dragon knew a spell that could reduce her bust-sized bulk enough to fit into tunnels only humans could normally navigate. Seemed unlikely, but... Merritt, he ventured, slashing blindly. This is a misunderstanding. I came to propose an alliance. If you have the Ring of Silence in your hoard, there's an opportunity for both of... A rough voice interrupted. Merritt will not treat with you, betrayer. Jason's eyes cleared enough for him to see that his foe was no dragon. But a hiss of surprise escaped Jason. A metallic mask set with a single ruby-red viewport covered the face of the creature advancing on him. Elaborate horns sprouted from its head behind the mask. He recognized it. A monitor. He supposed he shouldn't have been surprised. Monitors were what remained of Keflin, who once served the incarnation of silence. When silence disappeared, monitors remained. They were like ghosts haunting Ardeen, watching all that happened in quiet, oversized contemplation. They disengaged from every other interaction, friendship or cause. They didn't intercede, and didn't normally fight, preferring to flee violence so they could watch it from a safe distance. They waited for a sign from the incarnation of silence. Relief flooded him. It had surprised him, that was all, and a monitor wasn't truly a match for War. It was probably already retreating. Once Jason's vision completely cleared, the monitor wasn't moving off. The single red eye on its mast was fixed on him. Under the influence of that all-seeing gaze, Jason discovered he was unable to call up the Office of War and spawn duplicates. It wasn't fair. Jason was just getting used to the abilities the partly repowered Ring of War offered. To have those functions yanked away so precipitously sickened him. The creature charged. Jason swung his staff at its face. The monitor shifted, and he smashed down on one of its shoulders instead. Bone creaked, but the creature barely slowed. The monitor hit Jason like an avalanche and swept him out of the tunnel and into the cold, crisp evening air high on Mount Merritt. He didn't see the rocks on the path until he stumbled over them and fell. His head bounced off a boulder and everything swam. Part of Jason, the part that was War, screamed internally. That some creature could get the jump on an incarnation, let alone the incarnation of War, was unthinkable. For his part, Jason realized he'd gotten cocky. War's ring wasn't fully recharged, and apparently its power was still easily subverted. The monitor hit Jason while he was down, smashing him in the chest so hard he heard a rib crack. Then snugging a wide arm around Jason's neck in a stranglehold. Jason ceased straining after War's abilities. If he wasn't fully War again, at least he remained the betrayer, dammit, and he could fight dirty if need be. determination made him growl. He bit the arm, trying to squeeze his head off. Dry flesh tasting of dust and old leather filled his mouth. The pressure fell away. Jason leaped to his feet, careful to avoid pitching himself off the narrow path he'd followed up to the volcano's summit. The last bits of cottony streamers departed his vision. He watched the monitor retreat to the tunnel entrance, blocking it. Its breath heaved, and its shoulders shook, but its unwavering gaze never left Jason. "Your Merid's doorman?" Jason asked. "I thought she preferred other dragons as her servants." The monitor remained silent. "Or maybe she doesn't realize you're up here keeping guests from her parlor. You've been watching, haven't you? You've seen me collecting rings of the lost incarnations. So you waited up here to keep the Ring of Silence safe. I'm right, aren't I? Merid probably doesn't even know she has such a valuable treasure. I bet I'd do her a favor if I told her she was a lackey for Silence, watching..." The monitor thundered forward, easily covering the distance separating them. Jason was braced, but still went down when the bulk smashed into him. They rolled, and Jason lost his burning staff. The monitor's horns gouged Jason's sides. He elbowed the creature's neck, trying to smash in its windpipe. The flesh was more like wood than skin and bone, but something crunched, so he brought his elbow down on it a few more times, snarling in satisfaction. A horn slashed him deeper than before, but the hot whip of the laceration wasn't enough to stop the memory of war, the betrayer, or even Jason Cole. Unfortunately, they continued rolling. So instead of trying to crush the thing's skull between his two straining hands, Jason let go, latching onto a thorn bush instead. The thorns cut deep gouges down his palms and forearms, but the bush's roots held. The monitor realized its trajectory too late. It tried to grab Jason as it tumbled onward, but he kicked it. The creature flipped over the edge of the drop without a sound. Jason levered himself to his feet. His wounds stung, but without the monitor's mystical eye on him, the residual power of war was returning, numbing him to pain and hurt. He walked to the edge and gazed down the mountainous drop. He spied the broken remains of the monitor. It had bounced a few times on its way down and had fetched up a few thousand feet below on an outcrop. It wasn't getting up any time soon, if ever. Jason retrieved his staff. War's power surged from the ring on his finger, through his body, and into the implement, rekindling its head to bonfire brightness. "Let's try this again," he said, facing the unguarded entrance. "Anyone else want to try and stop me from coming inside?" No takers appeared. He entered, ready for another ambush that failed to materialize. The passage quickly descended into tight spirals. In the light of his conjured flame, Jason saw the tunnel rock was striated with crazy jags of green and purple sediment. He wasn't sure it made any kind of actual geological sense. Not that any of that mattered in Ardeen. Everything in the realm was, at its core, fake. He considered the state of his plan as he moved downward. Stealing the Ring of Death from Queen Elendine had proved both easier and harder than he'd anticipated. If he hadn't intervened, the Queen and her ring would have been Kraychow. That number of Kray inside Ardeen's border was beyond unusual, but then again the Moondor was known for being a place where the rules were flimsy. Something to do with allowing mystical access to the realm of the dead. He shrugged away the irrelevancy. The other ring he'd obtained since then hadn't required nearly so much activity or risk to his life as finding Elendine had. Following the gentle pulse of his own awakening ring, War had plucked the Ring of Commerce from the dusty collection of an antiquities dealer on the shores of Oceanus, who had no sense of its true worth. With his own ring of war, plus commerce and death, he needed just one more ring to bring his collection to four. Of course he'd had another ring, Desire, for many years, but he'd had to sacrifice it in order to get the whole ball rolling in the first place. He was just glad he didn't need all seven. Four rings was the magic number required to regain entry into the Maker's Hall, and Merid had the Ring of Silence. The tunnel finally emptied into a massive subterranean chamber lit by hundreds of torches. Jason was surprised to see the expansive space contained several human-sized wagons gathered around a lantern-lit caravanserai. A dragon's head with gray plumage stretched above the walled courtyard, and Jason stopped moving. It hadn't noticed him. He could hear the murmur of its speech from where he stood in the shadow of the chamber's periphery. It was bartering with unseen traders for water, amusements, and spices. He realized the gray wasn't married. His spies reported that her plumage was iridescent with reds, golds, blues, and greens. The gray must be a servant, one of several who dealt with human agents who in turn scoured Ardeen for treasures. The entire chamber was obviously merely a satellite room set aside for such interaction. It lay exterior to Merid's actual lair, which must lay deeper. At least five other passages, all of them larger and more obvious than the one he'd used to gain entry, exited the cavern. As he considered which one to take, someone tapped him on the shoulder. Jason spun around, his staff whipping through the air with lethal velocity. He barely managed to stop himself before he brained the woman who'd somehow snuck up on him so completely. She wore iridescent robes of shifting color. Her eyes glittered with a vitality more than merely human. A smell like cinnamon and burnt oranges filled his nostrils. He knew instantly who she was. Apparently, Merid did know how to shrink herself into a tunnel meant for humans. She could become human. The power to change form was a power some dragons possessed. "Merid, greetings," he said. "You know me, then," she said. "And I certainly recognize you, betrayer. Not that I needed to. Your scuffle with that interloper in my chimney was so loud it would have awakened me from a dead sleep." Jason was prepared to try to take the Ring of Silence by force if required. But he was caught off guard, literally, and Merid seemed in the mood to talk, maybe even deal. Might as well give it a try, he thought. He bent at the waist and swept his arm in a formal bow. "I am war. I seek an audience, great one, regarding a matter that could prove incredibly advantageous for both of us. So courteous, which I admire, especially in someone I caught trying to sneak in." "You were clever to catch me, Merid, and brave to do so alone, given my reputation." She laughed uproariously. He almost took offense. She said, "You're confident. I appreciate that. And I enjoy an actual conversation from time to time. My servants and agents, whether human, dragon, or Kefflum, are no fun. They believe that if they disagree with me, I'll bite their heads off." Jason nodded. He faced similar issues, especially among his more brainy homunculi, since he did tend to murder them if they gave him too much lip. His clones weren't really him, so it wasn't really murder. If she did the same among her own, he couldn't blame her. Merid touched his elbow and guided him toward the caravanserai. "I suggest we enjoy some strong coffee and smoke while we talk. What do you say, betrayer?" "Sounds wonderful." He'd spent 2 months pursuing his plans since he'd returned from Earth. One more evening wasn't going to derail him. They walked through an arched entrance into the caravanserai. In addition to several bright lanterns high on iron posts, the courtyard was decorated with colored lamps that hadn't been visible from outside. A pig-like creature roasted over a kitchen fire, sending a magnificent odor of cooking pork into the air that almost made Jason forget why he was there. The gray-feathered dragon and the small huddle of humans around it looked up at their entrance. The humans didn't noticeably react, but the gray dragon flinched. It at least knew who Merid was. "Please retire to your rooms and roosts," Merid ordered. The gray repeated the request, and the humans obliged with only a token protest. They finally retreated to the various rooms dotting the courtyard's inner wall. The dragon flew directly up into the darkness of the vast chamber. A couple of people shot him quizzical looks as they departed, but none voiced their questions. Merid walked Jason over to a large cabinet where they gathered utensils, mugs, and a nargila with two tubes. "Do you take smoke?"
"I've been known to indulge."
After some choice cuts of pig prepared over polenta in a spice sauce, a bowl of surprisingly exquisite tobacco, and iced coffee, Jason decided that Merid was truly a delightful conversationalist. Her reputation as one of the most terrifying creatures in the Daylands was obviously something she'd maintained as a front, though he detected an inner core of fire beneath her courteous exterior. The part of him that was war wondered what it would take to bring it to the surface. War anticipated testing himself against a dragon of the first brood. He blinked, and red dreams of tooth and sword retreated to the back of his mind. Jason inched forward slightly and said, "So, did you know a monitor was watching you?" Merid took another deep breath from the nargila tube. She blew it out to create a smoke sculpture of a dragon in flight. She said, "Of course. It was only doing what its sad kind always do, watching, until it attacked you," she said the last accusingly.
"Unexpected," he agreed. "I heard what you said to it. Perhaps you were right, and it hoped to safeguard something of value."
There went that advantage. "So, you know why I'm here. I'm hoping we can come to an arrangement. I'm not in the habit of distributing items from my collection. Each piece has its place. And the Ring of Silence, which I heard you name to the monitor, is one of my most cherished pieces. I well know what it is. I have it in a fabulous diorama."
War thundered, but Jason pushed thoughts of violence back. He said, "Hear me out. I can make this worth your while." Meredith looked at him with a skeptical tilt to her chin and eyebrow.
"Go on," she drawled.
"I have recovered nearly all War's strength," he said, shading the truth. "Why? Because my ring regained a measure of its ancient magic. It's not the only ring of incarnation to do so. I've learned that the other rings have regained a portion of their elan as well."
"Really?"
The glitter in Merid's eye went from joking to avarice.
"Of course," he said quickly. "Only heirs of the original incarnations can unlock the power of the rings, which means that to most alive in Ardeen today, they are merely baubles."
That was also true enough, though Jason actually suspected that anyone originally native to Earth could claim the power of a ring of incarnation. Thankfully, he was the only native of Earth he knew of still alive in all the land of the curse. The dragon said,
"Immensely valuable baubles, all the same.
If you can find the incarnation of Silence, or her heir, maybe.
But trust me, Silence is long gone, and she left no heirs.
She?" "I knew her secret name, Alice."
Jason gnawed his lip. He wasn't sure if he should have volunteered that information. It was a gamble. He hoped Merid could sense that he was telling the truth and not press the issue. He doubted that even a dragon as powerful as she knew the true nature of Ardeen's inception.
The dragon presumably thought she was thousands of years old, just like all the incarnations.
Better she keep that belief. He didn't know how she'd react if he let her in on Carter Morrison and his game made real.
Merritt said. How odd. Alice, eh? Not that it matters any longer. When you betrayed the Maker, did you also slay this Alice, or as the rest of us call her, Silence? But what if some of her great-great-grandchildren come asking after their lost trinket? He hadn't killed Silence, or any of the other incarnations. Just that bastard Carter. Well, not even him, as Carter's reappearance proved. Though Jason had certainly tried. He plunged the spike end of his burning staff into the Maker from behind. Jason watched Carter die. After that, things got confusing. He didn't really like to think about the considerable amount of time he'd lost. When he finally came back to himself, the power of war had left him, and the other incarnations were missing. He wondered if they'd simply disintegrated. If so, he was lucky the same thing hadn't happened to him. Of course, he'd been prepared, unlike the others. For years, he tried to discover what had actually happened to them, but finally grew tired of the search. If any remained alive, as he had in his reduced state, then they were keeping their distance from him. The fact that so many rings had turned up absent their owners suggested they were simply dead. Mara didn't need to know any of that. So he shrugged and said, "Indirectly, I suppose I did kill her." The dragon in woman form nodded thoughtfully. "That band on your finger is presumably the Ring of War?" Jason raised his left hand and made a fist, displaying the red metal loop. He nodded and couldn't restrain allowing a brief smile to twitch across his lips. "I'm so happy for you," Merritt said. "So what's Silence's ring to you, then? Unless you were lying, it won't work for you. I can't imagine war was an heir of Silence by any stretch of the imagination." He shrugged. "I have a different use for it in mind. As you know, the position of the Maker is vacant. What you may not know is that the Maker had a secret citadel. A place where he could rest his weary head after a long day screwing things up in Ardeen. It's called the Maker's Hall. It contains potent spells and rituals that will grant me all that I need to fully empower my own ring and become, as I once was, war in truth and not merely in name. Don't fancy being called the betrayer until the end of time?" He ignored her jibe and continued. "Of course, the Maker's Hall is sealed. It will only open to the Maker's hand or to one who holds any four of the seven." Realization of what he implied burned in Merritt's eyes. She wasn't slow, which was why he needed to keep as close to the truth as possible without revealing his entire plan. She'd probably object if she suspected he intended to step into the Maker's role, using war merely as a stepping stone. "What's in it for me, War?" He decided it was a good sign that she'd addressed him by his old title, finally. She was beginning to believe. "When I enter the Maker's Hall..." "When we enter the Maker's Hall, you mean," Merritt interrupted. Jason considered a moment. Allowing Merritt into the hall would introduce complications, but he couldn't put her off immediately or their talk was at an end. He said, "We can work out those details, of course. What I'm actually offering you is one of the rings of incarnation, enchanted, so it would work for you. You could have your choice of them, except for the Ring of War, of course," he chuckled. Merritt sucked in a breath, and he knew he had her. "An incarnation. That would be something." He smiled and nodded. "And all I have to do is give you the Ring of Silence? Lend it to me. If Silence is the incarnation you wish to become..." Merritt pondered. "Maybe." Though lore or desire could also prove diverting, each in their own way,